Hello, my name is Neil Donald Walsh. What you're about to hear is a portion of a 6-year dialogue which makes up a trilogy I have called Conversations with God. This program contains material from the third volume of that trilogy and touches subjects such as abortion, who we are and who we choose to be, and how life is lived elsewhere in the universe by highly evolved beings. Also in this volume is a discussion of the cosmology of all of life. And, at the end of this program, a summation of the 3 major points of the entire trilogy and a startling final wisdom which could set the human race free from any need to create negativity ever again on this planet. Now, if you're coming to the Conversations with God material for the first time, a brief explanation may be in order here. In 1992, I'd reached a low point in my life. Nothing was working. My relationships were falling apart. My career was coming to a dead end. Even my health was failing. In anguished despair, I called out to God, begging for answers to the questions which plague all of us at moments like this. What does it take to make life work? And what had I done to deserve a life of such continuing struggle? One night, I awoke in a fit of anger and wrote all these questions down on a yellow legal pad. And to my astonishment, even as I wrote them, I began to receive answers. I found my pen moving effortlessly across the page as I wrote out the thoughts being given to me by what I can only describe as a voiceless voice. I was receiving answers to my questions, and all I had to do was take dictation. And this I did, intermittently for 6 years, engaging in an ongoing dialogue covering an extraordinary range of topics. For once I started receiving answers, I did not stop asking questions. And this program is an audio presentation of a portion of that material. Because I received this dictation from a voiceless voice, that is, a voice having neither male nor female characteristics, it was important to me that the words of God on the audio program be assigned to both a man and a woman, so that the voice would not be gender-specific. I want to thank Edward Asner and Ellen Burstyn for reading this material with me and making it come alive. As we open this portion of the dialogue, I'm asking God, when does the soul join the body?
When do you think?
When it chooses to.
Good.
But people want a more definitive answer. They want to know when life begins, life as they know it.
I understand.
So what is the signal? Is it the emergence of the body from the womb, the physical birth? Is it the moment of conception, the physical joining of the elements of physical life?
Life has no beginning because life has no end. Merely extends, creates new forms.
It must be like that globby material in those heated lava lamps that were so popular in the 60s. Remember that? The globs would lay in big, soft, round balls at the bottom, then rise from the heat, separating and forming new globs, shaping themselves as they rose, rejoining each other at the top, cascading together to form even larger globs of the all, and starting all over again. There were never any new globs in the tubes. It was all the same stuff, reforming itself into what looked like new and different stuff. The varieties were endless. It was fascinating to watch the process unfold over and over again.
That's a great metaphor. That's how it is with souls. The one soul, which is really all there is, reforms itself into smaller and smaller parts of itself. All the parts were there at the beginning. There are no new parts, merely portions of the all that always was, reforming itself into what looks like new and different parts.
There's a brilliant pop song written and performed by Joan Osborne that asks, what if God were one of us, just a slob like one of us? I'm going to have to ask her to change the lyric line to, what if God was one of us, just a glob like one of us?
Yeah, that's very good. And you know, her song was a brilliant song. It pushed people's buttons all over the place. People couldn't stand the thought that I am no better than one of them.
That reaction is an interesting comment, not so much on God, but on the human race. If we consider it a blasphemy for God to be compared to one of us, what does that say about us?
What indeed?
Yet you are one of us. That's exactly what you've been saying here. So Joan was right.
She certainly was, profoundly right.
Well, I want to get back to my question. Can you tell us anything about when life as we know it starts? At what point does the soul enter the body?
The soul doesn't enter the body. The body is enveloped by the soul. Remember what I said before? The body does not house the soul. It is the other way around. Everything is always alive. There is no such thing as dead. There is no such state of being. That which is always alive simply shapes itself into a new form, a new physical form. That form is charged with living energy, the energy of life, always. Life, if you are calling life the energy that I am, is always there. It is never not there. Life never ends. So how can there be a point when life begins?
Come on, help me out here. You know what I'm trying to get at.
Yes, I do. You want me to enter the abortion debate?
Yes, I do. I admit it. I mean, I've got God here, and I have a chance to ask the monumental question. When does life begin?
And the answer is so monumental, you can't hear it.
Try me again.
It never begins. Life never begins. Because life never ends. You want to get into biological technicalities so that you can make up a rule based on what you want to call God's law about how people should behave. Then punish them if they do not behave that way.
What's wrong with that? That would allow us to kill doctors in the parking lots of clinics with impunity.
Yes, I understand. You have used me and what you have declared to be my laws as justification for all sorts of things through the years.
Oh, come on. Why won't you just say that terminating a pregnancy is murder?
You cannot kill anyone or anything.
No, but you can end its individuation, and in our language, that's killing.
You cannot stop the process wherein which a part of me individually expresses in a certain way without the part of me that is expressing in that way agreeing.
What? What are you saying?
I am saying that nothing happens against the will of God. Life and all that is occurring is an expression of God's will. Read that, your will, made manifest. I have said in this dialogue, your will is my will. That is because there is only one of us. Life is God's will, expressing perfectly. If something was happening against God's will, it couldn't happen. By definition of who and what God is, it couldn't happen. Do you believe that one soul can somehow decide something for another? Do you believe that as individuals you can affect each other in ways in which the other does not want to be affected? Such a belief would have to be based on the idea that you are separate from each other. Do you believe that you can somehow affect life in a way in which God does not want life to be affected? Such a belief would have to be based on an idea that you are separate from me. Both ideas are false. It is arrogant beyond measure for you to believe that you can affect the universe in a way with which the universe does not agree. You are dealing with mighty forces here, and some of you believe that you are mightier than the mightiest force. Yet you are not, nor are you less mighty than the mightiest force. You are the mightiest force. No more, no less. So let the force be with you.
Are you saying that I can't kill anybody without his or her permission? Are you telling me that at some higher level, everyone who has ever been killed has agreed to be killed?
You are looking at things in earthly terms and thinking of things in earthly terms, and none of this is going to make sense to you.
I can't help thinking in earthly terms. I am here, right now, on the earth.
I tell you this. You are in this world, but not of it.
So my earthly reality is not reality at all?
Did you really think it was?
I don't know.
You've never thought there's something larger going on here?
Well, yes, sure I have.
Well, this is what's going on. I'm explaining it to you.
Okay. Okay, I got it. So that means I guess I can just go out and kill anybody because I couldn't have done it anyway if they hadn't agreed.
In fact, the human race acts that way. It's interesting that you're having such a hard time with this, that you're going around acting as if it were true anyway. Or worse yet, you are killing people against their will as if it didn't matter.
Well, of course it matters. It's just that what we want matters more. Don't you get it? In the moment we humans kill somebody, we're not saying that the fact that we've done that doesn't matter. It would be flippant to think that. It's just that what we want matters more.
I see. So it's easier for you to accept that it's okay to kill others against their will. This you can do with impunity. It's doing it because it is their will that you feel is wrong.
I never said that. That's not how humans think.
It isn't? Let me show you how hypocritical some of you are. You say it is okay to kill somebody against their will so long as you have a good and sufficient reason for wanting them dead, as in war, for instance, or an execution, or a doctor in the parking lot of an abortion clinic. Yet if the other person feels they have a good and sufficient reason for wanting themselves dead, you may not help them die. That would be assisted suicide, and that would be wrong.
Now you're making mock of me.
No. You are making mock of me. You are saying that I would condone your killing someone against his will, and that I would condemn your killing someone in accordance with his will. This is insane. Still, you not only fail to see the insanity, You actually claim that those who point out the insanity are the ones who are crazy. You are the ones who have your head on straight. And they are just troublemakers. Now, this is the kind of tortured logic with which you construct entire lives and complete theologies.
I never looked at it quite that way.
I tell you this, the time has come for you to look at things a new way. This is the moment of your rebirth, as an individual and as a society. You must recreate your world now before you destroy it with your insanities. Now listen to me. We are all one. There is only one of us. You are not separate from me. And you are not separate from each other. Everything we are doing in concert with each other. Our reality is a co-created reality. If you terminate a pregnancy, we terminate a pregnancy. Your will is my will. No individual aspect of divinity has power over any other aspect of divinity. It is not possible for one soul to affect another against its will. There are no victims and there are no villains. You cannot understand this from your limited perspective, but I am telling you it is so. There's only one reason to be, do, or have anything as a direct statement of who you are. If who you are as an individual and as a society is who you choose and desire to be, there's no reason to change anything. If, on the other hand, you believe there's a grander experience waiting to be had, an even greater expression of divinity than the one currently manifesting, then move into that truth. Since all of us are co-creating, it may serve us to do what we can to show others the way that some parts of us wish to go. You can be a way-shower, demonstrating the life that you'd like to create, and inviting others to follow your example. You might even say, I am the life and the way. Follow me. But be careful. Some people have been crucified for making such statements.
Thank you. I'll heed the warning. I'll keep a low profile.
I can see that you're doing a real good job of that.
Well, when you say you're having a conversation with God, it's not easy to keep a low profile.
As others have discovered.
Which might be a good reason for me to keep my mouth shut.
It's a little late for that.
Well, whose fault is that?
I see what you mean.
It's okay. I forgive you.
You do?
Yes.
How can you forgive me?
Because I can understand why you did it. I understand why you came to me, started this dialogue. And when I understand why something was done, I can forgive all the complications that it may have caused or created.
That's interesting. Would that you could think of God as being so magnificent as you.
Touché.
You have an unusual relationship with me. In some ways you think you could never be as magnificent as me. And in other ways you think I cannot be as magnificent as you. That's funny and interesting.
Fascinating.
Because you think we are separated. These imaginings would leave you if you thought that we were one. This is the main difference between your culture, which is a baby culture, really, a primitive culture, and the highly evolved cultures of the universe. The most significant difference is that in highly evolved cultures, all sentient beings are clear that there is no separation between themselves and what you call God.
They are also clear that there is no separation between themselves and others. They know that they are each having an individual experience of the whole.
Oh, good. Now you're going to get into the highly evolved societies of the universe. I've been waiting for this.
Yes, I think it's time we explored that.
But before we do, I simply must return one last time to the abortion issue. You're not saying here, are you, that because nothing can happen to the human soul against its will, it's okay to kill people? You're not condoning abortion or giving us a way out on this issue, are you?
I'm neither condoning nor condemning abortion any more than I condone or condemn war. The people of every country think I condone the war they are fighting and condemn the war that their opponent is fighting. The people of every nation believe they have God on their side. Every cause assumes the same thing. Indeed, every person feels the same thing, or at least hopes it is true whenever any decision or choice is made. And do you know why all creatures believe God is on their side? Because I am. And all creatures have an intuitive knowing of this. This is just another way of saying, your will for you is my will for you. And that is just another way of saying, I have given you all free will. There is no free will if to exercise it in certain ways produces punishment. That makes a mockery of free will and renders it counterfeit. So with regard to abortion or war, buying that car or marrying that person or having sex or not having sex, doing your duty or not doing your duty, there is no such thing as right or wrong, and I have no preference in the matter. You are all in the process of defining yourselves. Every act is an act of self-definition. If you are pleased with how you have created yourself, if it serves you, you will continue doing so in that way. If you are not, you will stop. This is called evolution. The process is slow because as you evolve, you keep changing your ideas about what really serves you. You keep changing your concepts of pleasure. Remember what I said earlier? You can tell how highly a person or society has evolved by what that being or society calls pleasure. And I will add here, by what it declares to serve it. If it serves you to go to war and kill other beings, you will do so. If it serves you to terminate a pregnancy, you will do so. The only thing that changes as you evolve is your idea of what serves you. And that is based on what you think you are trying to do. If you are trying to get to Seattle, it will not serve you to head toward San Jose. It is not morally wrong to go to San Jose. It simply doesn't serve you. The question of what you are trying to do then becomes a question of prime importance, not just in your life in general, but in every moment of your life specifically. Because it is in the moments of life that a life itself is created. All of this was covered in great detail in the beginning of our holy dialogue, which you have come to call Book One. I'm repeating it here because you seem to need a reminder, or you would never have asked me your question on abortion. When you are preparing to have your abortion, therefore, or when you are preparing to smoke that cigarette, or when you are preparing to fry and eat that animal, and when you are preparing to cut that man off in traffic, whether the matter is large or small, whether the choice is major or minor, there is only one question to consider. Is this who I really am? Is this who I now choose to be? And understand this. No matter is inconsequential. There is a consequence to everything. The consequence is who and what you are. You are in the act of defining yourself right now. That is your answer to the abortion question. That is your answer to the war question. That is your answer to the smoking question and the meat-eating question and to every question about behavior you've ever had. Every act is an act of self-definition. Everything you think, say, and do declares, this is who I am. I want to tell you, my dearest children, that this matter of who you are and who you choose to be is of great importance, not only because it sets the tone of your experience, but because it creates the nature of mine. All of your life you have been told that God created you. I come now to tell you this. You are creating God. That is a massive rearrangement of your understanding, I know. And yet it is a necessary one if you are to go about the true work for which you came. This is holy work we are up to, you and I. This is sacred ground we walk. This is the path. In every moment, God expresses himself in, as, and through you. You are always at choice as to how God will be created now, and I will never take that choice from you, nor will I punish you for making the wrong choice. Yet you are not without guidance in these matters, nor will you ever be. Built into you is an internal guidance system that shows you the way home. This is the voice that speaks to you always of your highest choice, that places before you your grandest vision. All you need do is heed that voice and not abandon the vision. Throughout your history, I've sent you teachers. During every day and time have my messengers brought you glad tidings of great joy. Holy scriptures have been written and holy lives have been lived that you might know of this eternal truth. You and I are one. Now again, I send you scriptures. You are writing them right now. Now again I send you messengers, seeking to bring you the word of God. Will you listen to these words? Will you hear these messengers? Will you become one of them? That is the great question. That is the grand invitation. That is the glorious decision. The world awaits your announcement. And you make that announcement with your life lived. The human race has no chance to lift itself from its own lowest thoughts until you lift yourself to your own highest ideas. Those ideas expressed through you, as you create the template, set the stage, serve as a model for the next level of human experience. You are the life and the way. The world will follow you. You are not at choice in this matter. It is the only matter in which you have no free choice. It is simply the way it is. Your world will follow your idea about yourself. Ever it has been, ever it will be. First comes your thought about yourself, then follows the outer world of physical manifestation. What you think, you create. What you create, you become. What you become, you express. What you express, you experience. What you experience, you are. What you are, you think. The circle is complete. The holy work in which you are engaged has really just begun, for now at last you understand what you are doing. It is you who have caused yourself to know this. You who have caused yourself to care, and you do care now, more than ever before, about who you really are. For now at last you see the whole picture. Who you are, I am. You are defining God. I have sent you a blessed part of me into physical form that I might know myself experientially as all that I know myself to be conceptually. Life exists as a tool for God to turn concepts into experience. It exists for you to do the same, for you are God doing this. I choose to recreate myself anew in every single moment. I choose to experience the grandest version of the greatest vision ever I had about who I am. I have created you so that you might recreate me. This is our holy work. This is our greatest joy. This is our very reason for being.
You know, I'm filled with awe and reverence at the reading of those words. Thanks for being here with me in this way. Thanks for being here with all of us.
You're welcome. Thank you for being here for me.
I've just got a few remaining questions, some having to do with those evolved beings, and then I'm going to allow myself to finish this dialogue.
My beloved, you will never finish this dialogue, nor will you ever have to. Your conversation with God will go on forever. And now that you're actively engaged in it, that conversation will soon lead to friendship. All good conversations eventually lead to friendship, and soon your conversation with God will produce a friendship with God.
You know, I feel that. I feel that we've actually become friends.
And, as happens in all relationships, that friendship, if it is nurtured, kindled, and allowed to grow, will produce, at last, a sense of communion. You will feel and experience yourself as being in communion with God. This will be a holy communion, for then we will speak as one.
So, this dialogue will continue then?
Yes, always.
And I won't have to say goodbye at the end of this book.
You never have to say goodbye. You only have to say hello.
You're marvelous. Do you know that? You're simply marvelous.
And so are you, my son, and so are you, as are all my children everywhere.
Say, do you have children everywhere?
Of course.
No. I mean, literally, everywhere. I mean, is there life on other planets? Are your children elsewhere in the universe?
Again, of course.
Are these civilizations more advanced?
Some of them, yes.
In what way?
In every way. Technologically, politically, socially, spiritually, physically, and psychologically. For instance, your penchant for, your insistence upon comparisons, and your constant need to characterize something as better or worse, higher or lower, good or bad, demonstrates how far into duality you have fallen, how deeply into separatism you have submerged.
In more advanced civilizations, you do not observe these characteristics? And what do you mean, by the way, by duality?
The level of a society's advancement is reflected inevitably in the degree of its duality thinking. Social evolution is demonstrated by movement toward unity, not separatism.
Why? Why is unity such a yardstick?
Because unity is the truth. Separatism is the illusion. As long as a society sees itself as separate, a series or collection of separate units, it lives in the illusion. All of life on your planet is built on separatism, based in duality. You imagine yourselves to be separate families or clans, gathered in separate neighborhoods or states, collected in separate nations or countries, comprising a separate world or planet. You imagine your world to be the only inhabited world in the universe. You imagine your nation to be the finest nation on earth. You imagine your state to be the best state in the nation, and your family the most wonderful in the state. Finally, you think that you are better than anyone else in your family. Oh, you claim you don't think any of this, but you act as if you do. Your true thoughts are reflected every day in your social decisions, your political conclusions, your religious determinations, your economic choices, and your individual selections of everything, from friends to belief systems, to your relationship with God, that is, me. You feel so separate from me that you imagine I won't even talk to you. And so you are required to deny the veracity of your own experience. You experience that you and I are one, but you refuse to believe it. Thus, you are separate not only from each other, but from your own truth.
Whoa, how can a person be separate from his or her own truth?
By ignoring it, by seeing it and denying it, or by changing it, twisting it, contorting it to fit a preconceived notion you have about what must be so. Take the question with which you started off here. You asked, is there life on other planets? I answered, of course.
I said, of course, because the evidence is so obvious. It is so obvious that I'm surprised you even asked the question. Yet this is how a person can be separate from his own truth, by looking truth in the eye so squarely he can't miss it, and then denying what he sees. Denial is the mechanism here. And nowhere is denial more insidious than in self-denial. You've spent a lifetime denying who and what you really are. It would be sad enough if you limited your denials to less personal things, such as your depletion of the ozone layer, your rape of old-growth forests, your horrible treatment of your young. But you're not content with denying all that you see around you. You won't rest until you deny all that you see within you as well. You see goodness and compassion within you, but you deny it. You see wisdom within you, but you deny it. You see infinite possibility within you, but you deny it. And you see and experience God within you, yet you deny it. You deny that I am within you, that I am you. And in this you deny me my rightful and obvious place.
I have not and do not deny you.
You admit that you are God?
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Exactly. And I tell you this, before the cock crows, you will deny me three times. By your very thoughts will you deny me. By your very words will you deny me. By your very actions will you deny me. You know in your heart that I am with you, in you, that we are one, yet you deny me. Well, some of you say I exist, all right, but away from you, way out there somewhere. And the further away you imagine me to be, the further away you step from your own truth. As with so much else in life, from depletion of your planet's natural resources to the abuse of children in so many of your homes, you see it, but you don't believe it.
But why? Why? Why do we see and yet not believe?
Because you are so caught up in the illusion, you are so deep in the illusion that you cannot see past it. Indeed, you must not for the illusion to continue. This is the divine dichotomy. You must deny me if you are to continue seeking to become me. And that is what you are wanting to do. Yet you cannot become what you already are, so denial is important. It is a useful tool. Until it is not anymore. The Master knows that denial is for those who are choosing to have the illusion continue. Acceptance is for those who choose now for the illusion to end. Acceptance, proclamation, demonstration. Those are the three steps to God. Acceptance of who and what you really are. Proclamation of it for all the world to hear, and demonstration in every way. Self-proclamation is always followed by demonstration. You will demonstrate yourself to be God, even as you now demonstrate what you think of yourself. Your whole life is a demonstration of that. Yet with this demonstration will come your greatest challenge. For the moment you stop denying yourself, others will deny you. The moment you proclaim your oneness with God, others will proclaim your partnership with Satan. The moment you speak the highest truth, others will say you speak the lowest blasphemy. And as happens with all masters who gently demonstrate their mastery, you will be both worshipped and reviled, elevated and denigrated, honored and crucified. Because while for you the cycle will be over, those who are still living in the illusion will not know what to make of you.
Yet what will happen to me? I don't understand. I'm confused. I thought you've said over and over again that the illusion must go on, that the game must continue in order for there to be any game at all.
Yes, I have said that, and it does. The game does go on. because one or two of you end the cycle of illusion, that does not end the game. Not for you, and not for the other players. The game is not ended until all in all becomes one again. Even then it is not ended. For in the moment of divine reunion, all with all, will the bliss be so magnificent, so intense, that I, we, you will literally burst wide open with gladness, exploding with joy, and the cycle will begin all over again. It will never end, my child. The game will never end, for the game is life itself, and life is who we are.
But what happens to the individual element, or part of all, as you call it, which rises to mastery, which achieves all-knowing?
That master knows that only his part of the cycle is complete. She knows that only her experience of the illusion has ended. Now the master laughs because the master sees the master plan. The master sees that even with her completion of the cycle, the game goes on. The experience continues. The master then also sees the role he may now play in the experience. The master's role is to lead others to mastery. And so the master continues to play, but in a new way and with new tools. For seeing the illusion allows the master to step outside of it. This the master will do from time to time when it suits his purpose and pleasure. Thus she proclaims and demonstrates her mastery, and he is called God Goddess by others. When all in your race are led to mastery and achieve it, then your race as a whole, for your race is a whole, will move easily through time and space. You will have mastered the laws of physics as you understood them. And you will seek to assist those belonging to other races and other civilizations in coming to mastery as well.
Even as those of other races and other civilizations are doing so now with us?
Exactly. Precisely.
And only when all the races of all the universe have achieved mastery.
Or, as I would put it, only when all of me has known the oneness.
Will this part of the cycle end?
You've put it wisely. For the cycle itself will never end.
Because the very ending of this part of the cycle is the cycle itself.
Bravo! Magnifico! You have understood. So, yes, there is life on other planets, and yes, much of it is more advanced than your own.
In what way? You never really did answer that question.
Yes, I did. I said in every way. Technologically, politically, socially, spiritually, physically, psychologically.
Yes, but give me some examples. Those are statements so broad that they are meaningless to me.
You know, I love your truth. It's not everyone who would look God in the eye and announce that what he is saying is meaningless.
So, what are you going to do about it?
Exactly. You have exactly the right attitude. Because, of course, you're right. You can challenge me, confront me, and call me into question as much as you want, and I'm not going to do a damn thing. I may, however, do a blessed thing. Just as I'm doing here with this dialogue. Is this not a blessed event?
Yes, yes, it is. And many people have been helped by this. Millions of people are being touched by this.
I know that. It's all part of the master plan. The plan for how you become masters.
You knew from the beginning that this trilogy would become a massive success, didn't you?
Of course I did. Who do you suppose has made it such a success? Who do you imagine has caused those people who are hearing this to have found their way to it? I tell you this. I know every person who will come to this material. And I know the reason each has been brought. And so do they. Now the only question is, will they deny me again?
Does it matter to you?
Not in the least. All my children will one day come back to me. It is not a question of whether, but of when. And so it may matter to them. Therefore, let those who have ears to hear listen.
Yes. Well, we were talking about life on other planets, and you were about to give me some examples of how it is so much more advanced than life on Earth.
Technologically, most other civilizations are far ahead of you. Now, those which are behind you, so to speak, but not many, most are far ahead of you.
In what way? Give me an example.
Okay. The weather. You don't seem able to control it. You can't even accurately predict it. You are therefore subject to its whims. Most worlds are not. The beings on most planets can control the local temperature, for example.
They can. I thought temperature on a planet was a product of its distance from the sun, its atmosphere, so forth.
Those things establish the parameters. Within those parameters, much can be done.
How so? In what way?
By controlling the environment, by creating or failing to create certain conditions in the atmosphere. You see, it's not only a matter of where you are in relationship to a sun, but what you place between yourself and that sun. You have placed the most dangerous things in your atmosphere and taken out some of the most important. Yet you are in denial about this. That is, most of you will not admit it. Even when the finest minds among you prove beyond doubt the damage you are doing, you will not acknowledge it. You call the finest minds among you crazed and say that you know better. Or you see that these wise people only have an axe to grind, a point of view to validate, and their own interests to protect. Yet it is you who are grinding an axe. It is you who are seeking to validate a point of view. And it is you who are protecting your special interests. And your chief interest is yourself. Every evidence, no matter how scientific, no matter how demonstrable or compelling, will be denied if it violates your self-interest.
That's a rather harsh statement. I'm not even sure it's true.
Really? Now you're calling God a liar?
Well, I wouldn't put it that way, exactly.
Do you know how long it has taken your nations to agree to simply stop poisoning the atmosphere with fluorocarbons?
Yes, well...
Well, nothing. Why do you suppose it took so long? Never mind, I'll tell you. It took so long because to stop the poisoning would cost many major companies a great deal of money. It took so long because it would cost many individual people their conveniences. It took so long because for years many people and nations chose to deny, needed to deny, the evidence in order to protect their interest in the status quo, in keeping things the way they are. Only when the rate of skin cancers increased alarmingly. Only when the temperatures began rising and the glaciers and snows began melting and the oceans got warmer and the lakes and rivers began flooding did more of you begin paying attention. Only when your own self-interest demanded it did you see the truth that your finest minds had been placing before you for years.
Well, what's wrong with self-interest? I thought you said in book one that self-interest was the place to start.
I did, and it is. Yet in other cultures and other societies on different planets, the definition of self-interest is much larger than it is on your world. It is very clear to enlightened creatures that what hurts one hurts the many, and that what benefits the few must benefit the many, or ultimately it benefits no one. On your planet, it is just the opposite. What hurts one is ignored by the many, and what benefits the few is denied the many. This is because your definition of self-interest is very narrow, barely reaching past the individual being to his loved ones, and to those only when they do his bidding. Yes, I said in book one that in all relationships, do what is in the best interests of the self. But I also said that when you see what is in your highest self-interest, you will see that it is that which is also in the highest interest of the other. For you and the other are one. You and all others are one. And this is a level of knowingness that you have not attained. You're asking about advanced technologies, and I tell you this, you cannot have advanced technologies in any beneficial way without advanced thinking. Advanced technology without advanced thought creates not advancement, but demise. You've already experienced that on your planet, and you are very nearly about to experience it again.
Whoa, wait a minute. What do you mean? What are you talking about?
I am saying that once before, on your planet, you had reached the heights, beyond the heights, really, to which you now are slowly climbing. You had a civilization on Earth more advanced than the one now existing, and it destroyed itself. Not only did it destroy itself, it nearly destroyed everything else as well. It did this because it did not know how to deal with the very technologies it had developed. Its technological evolution was so far ahead of its spiritual evolution that it wound up making technology its god. The people worshipped technology and all that it could create and bring, and so they got all that their unbridled technology brought, which was unbridled disaster. They literally brought their world to an end.
This all happened here, on this Earth?
Yes.
Are you talking about the lost city of Atlantis?
Some of you have called it that.
And Lemuria, the land of Mu?
That is also part of your mythology.
So that it is true. We did get to that place before.
Oh, beyond it, my friend. Way beyond it.
And we did destroy ourselves.
Why are you surprised? You're doing the same thing now.
I know we are. Will you tell us how we can stop?
There are many other books devoted to this subject. Most people ignore them.
Well, give us one title. I promise you we won't ignore it.
Read The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight.
By a man named Tom Hartman. Yes, I love that book.
Good. This messenger is inspired. Bring this book to the attention of the world.
I will.
It says everything that I would say here in answer to your last question. There's no need for me to rewrite that book through you. It contains a summary of many of the ways in which your Earth home is being damaged and ways that you can stop the ruination.
So far, what the human race has been doing on this planet is not very smart. In fact, throughout this dialogue, you've described our species as primitive. Ever since you first made that remark, I've been wondering what it must be like living in a non-primitive culture. You say there are many such societies or cultures in the universe.
Yes.
How many?
Oh, a great many.
Dozens? Hundreds?
Thousands.
Thousands? There are thousands of advanced civilizations?
Yes, and there are other cultures more primitive than yours.
What else marks a society as either primitive or advanced?
The degree to which it implements its own highest understandings. This is different from what you believe. You believe that a society should be called primitive or advanced based on how high its understandings are. But what good are the highest understandings if you do not implement them? The answer is they're no good at all. Indeed, they are dangerous. It is the mark of a primitive society to call regression progress. Your society has moved backward, not forward. Much of your world demonstrated more compassion 70 years ago than it does today.
Some people are going to have a hard time hearing this, you know. You say you're a non-judgmental God, yet some people may feel judged and made wrong all over the place here.
We've been over this before. If you say you want to go to Seattle and you're actually driving to San Jose, is the person of whom you're asking directions being judgmental if you're told you're heading in a direction that won't get you where you say you want to go?
Calling us primitive is not simply giving us directions. The word primitive is pejorative.
Really? And yet you say you so admire primitive art, and certain music is often savored for its primitive qualities, to say nothing of certain women.
You're using wordplay now to change things around.
Not at all. I'm merely showing you that primitive is not necessarily pejorative. It is your judgment that makes it so. Primitive is merely descriptive. It simply says what is true. A certain thing is in the very early stages of development. It says nothing more than that. It says nothing about right or wrong. You add those meanings. I have not made you wrong here. I have merely described your culture as primitive. That would only sound wrong to you if you have a judgment about being primitive. I have no such judgment. Understand this. An assessment is not a judgment. It is merely an observation of what is. I want you to know that I love you. I have no judgments about you. I look at you and see only beauty and wonder.
Like that primitive art.
Precisely. I hear your melody and I feel only excitement.
As with primitive music.
You're understanding me now. I feel the energy of your race as you would the energy of a man or woman of primitive sensuality. And like you, I am aroused. Now that is what is true about you and me. You do not disgust me. You do not disturb me. You do not even disappoint me. You arouse me. I am aroused to new possibilities, to new experiences yet to come. In you, I am awakened to new adventures and to the excitement of movement to new levels of magnificence. Far from disappointing me, you thrill me. I am thrilled at the wonder of you. You think you are at the pinnacle of human development, and I tell you, you're just beginning. You have only just begun to experience your splendor. Your grandest ideas are as yet unexpressed, and your grandest vision unlived. But wait, look, notice. The days of your blossoming are at hand. The stalk has grown strong, and the petals are soon to open. And I tell you this, the beauty and the fragrance of your flowering shall fill the land, and you shall yet have your place in the garden of the gods.
Now that's what I want to hear. That's what I came here to experience. Inspiration, not degradation.
You are never degraded unless you think you are. You are never judged or made wrong by God.
Well, a lot of people don't get this idea of a God who says there's no such thing as right and wrong and who proclaims that we will never be judged.
Well, make up your mind. First you say I'm judging you, then you're upset because I'm not.
I know. It's all very confusing. We're all very complex. We don't want your judgments, but we do. We don't want your punishments, yet we feel lost without them. And when you say, as you did in the other two books, I will never punish you, we can't believe that. And some of us almost get mad about it, because if you're not going to judge and punish us, what will keep us walking the straight and narrow? And if there's no justice in heaven, who will undo all the injustice on earth?
Why are you counting on heaven to correct what you call injustice? Do not the rain fall from the heavens?
Yes.
And I tell you this, the rain falls on the just and the unjust alike.
But what about vengeance is mine, saith the Lord?
I never said that. One of you made that up, and the rest of you believed it.
Oh.
Justice is not something you experience after you act a certain way, but because you act a certain way. Justice is an act, not a punishment for an act.
I see that the problem with our society is that we seek justice after an injustice has occurred, rather than doing justice in the first place.
Right on the head. You've hit the nail right on the head. Justice is an action, not a reaction. Do not therefore look to me to somehow fix everything in the end by imposing
some form of celestial justice in the afterlife. I tell you this, there is no afterlife, but only life. Death does not exist. And the way you experience and create your life as individuals and as a society is your demonstration of what you think is just.
And in this, you do not see the human race as very evolved, do you? I mean, if the whole of evolution were placed on a football field, where would we be?
On the 12-yard line.
You're kidding.
No.
We're on the 12-yard line of evolution?
Hey, you've moved from the 6 to the 12 in the past century alone.
Any chance of ever scoring a touchdown?
Of course. If you don't fumble the ball again.
Again?
As I've said, this isn't the first time your civilization has been at this brink. I want to repeat this because it is vital that you hear this. Once before on your planet, the technology you developed was far greater than your ability to use it responsibly. You're approaching the same point in human history again. It's vitally important that you understand this. Your present technology is threatening to outstrip your ability to use it wisely. Your society is on the verge of becoming a product of your technology, rather than your technology being a product of your society. When a society becomes a product of its own technology, it destroys itself.
Why is that? Can you explain that?
Yes. The crucial issue is the balance between technology and cosmology, the cosmology of all life.
What do you mean, the cosmology of all life?
Simply put, it is the way things work, the system, the process. There is a method to my madness, you know.
I was hoping there was.
And the irony is that once you figure out that method, once you begin to understand more and more of how the universe works, you run a greater risk of causing a breakdown. In this way, ignorance can be bliss. The universe is itself a technology. It is the greatest technology. It works perfectly, on its own. But once you get in there and start messing around with universal principles and universal laws, you run the risk of breaking those laws. And that's a 40-yard penalty.
A major setback for the home team.
Yes.
So, are we out of our league here?
You're getting close. Only you can determine whether you're out of your league. You'll determine that with your actions. For instance, you know enough about atomic energy now to blow yourselves to kingdom come.
Yeah, but we're not going to do that. We're smarter than that. We'll stop ourselves.
Really? You keep proliferating your weapons of mass destruction the way you've been doing, and pretty soon they'll get into the hands of somebody who will hold the world hostage to them or destroy the world trying. You're giving matches to children, then hoping they won't burn the place down, and you've yet to learn how to use the matches yourselves. The solution to all this is obvious. Take the matches away from the children, then throw your own matches away.
Well, it's too much to expect a primitive society to disarm itself. And so nuclear disarmament, our only lasting solution, appears out of the question. We can't even agree on a halt to nuclear testing. We are a race of beings singularly unable to control ourselves.
And if you don't kill yourselves with your nuclear madness, you'll destroy your world with your environmental suicide. You are dismantling your home planet's ecosystem, and you continue to say that you're not. As if that weren't enough, you're tinkering with the biochemistry of life itself, cloning and genetically engineering, and not doing so with sufficient care to have this be a boon to your species, but threatening instead to make it the greatest disaster of all time. If you are not careful, you will make the nuclear and environmental threats look like child's play. By developing medicines to do the work that your bodies were intended to do, you've created viruses so resistant to attack that they stand poised to knock out your entire species.
Hey, you're getting me a little scared here. Is all lost then? Is the game over?
No, but it is 4th and 10. It's time to throw a Hail Mary, and the quarterback is looking around for receivers in the clear. Are you clear? Are you able to receive this? I'm the quarterback, and the last time I looked, you and I were wearing the same colored jersey. Are we still on the same team?
I thought there was only one team. Who's on the other team?
Every thought which ignores our oneness, every idea which separates us, every action which announces that we are not united. The other team is not real, yet it is part of your reality, for you have made it so. You are not careful. Your own technology, that which was created to serve you, will kill you.
Right now I can hear some people saying, but what can one person do?
They can start by dropping that what can one person do stuff. I've already told you. There are hundreds of books on this subject. Stop ignoring them. Read them. Act on them. Awaken others to them. Start a revolution. Make it an evolution revolution.
Isn't that what's been going on for a long time?
Yes and no. The process of evolution has been ongoing forever, of course. But now that process is taking a new twist. There's a new turn here. Now you have become aware that you are evolving. And not only that you are evolving, but how. Now you know the process by which evolution occurs and through which your reality is created. Before, you were simply an observer of how your species was evolving. Now you are a conscious participant. More people than ever before are aware of the power of the mind, their interconnectedness with all things, and their real identity as a spiritual being. More people than ever before are living from that space, practicing principles that invoke and produce specific results, desired outcomes, and intended experiences. This truly is an evolution revolution. For now, larger and larger numbers of you are creating consciously the quality of your experience, the direct expression of who you really are, and the rapid manifestation of who you choose to be. That's what makes this such a critical period. That's why this is the crucial moment. For the first time in your presently recorded history, although not for the first time in human experience, you have both the technology and the understanding of how to use it to destroy your entire world. You can actually render yourselves extinct.
These are the exact points made in a book by Barbara Marx Hubbard called Conscious Evolution.
Yes, that is so.
It's a document of breathtaking sweep, with wondrous visions of how we can avoid the dire outcomes of previous civilizations and truly produce heaven on earth. You probably inspired it.
I think Barbara might say that I had a hand in it.
You know, you said before that you've inspired hundreds of writers, many messengers. Are there other books we should be aware of?
Way too many to list here. Why not conduct your own search and make a list of the ones that have particularly appealed to you and share that with others? I have been speaking through authors, poets, and playwrights from the beginning of time. I've placed my truth in the lyrics of songs and on the faces of paintings, in the shapes of sculptures, and in every beat of the human heart for ages past, and I will for ages to come. Each person comes to wisdom in a way that is most understandable, along a path that is most familiar. Each messenger of God derives truth from the simplest moments and shares it with equal simplicity. You are such a messenger. Go now and tell your people to live together in their highest truth. Share together their wisdom, experience together their love, for they can exist in peace and harmony. Then will yours, too, be an elevated society, such as those we have been discussing.
So the main difference between our society and more highly evolved civilizations elsewhere in the universe is this idea we have of separation.
Yes. The first guiding principle of advanced civilization is unity, acknowledgement of the oneness and the sacredness of all life. And so what we find in all elevated societies is that under no circumstances would one being willfully take the life of another of its own species against its will.
No circumstances?
None.
Even if it were being attacked?
Such a circumstance would not occur within that society or species.
Well, perhaps not within the species, but what about from without?
If a highly evolved species were attacked by another, it is a guarantee that the attacker would be the lesser evolved. Indeed, the attacker would be essentially a primitive being, for no evolved being would attack anyone.
I see.
The only reason a species under attack would kill another would be that the attacked being forgot who it really is. If the first being thought it was its corporal body, its physical form, then it might kill its attacker, for it would fear the end of its own life. If, on the other hand, the first being understood full well that it was not its body, it would never end the corporal existence of another, for it would never have a reason to. It would simply lay down its own corporal body and move into the experience of its non-corporal self.
Like Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Well, exactly. The writers of what you call your science fiction are often leading you to greater truth.
I've got to stop here. This seems directly at variance with what was said in Book One.
What was that?
Book One said that when someone is abusing you, it does no good to allow the abuse to continue. Book One said that when acting with love, include yourself among those you love. And the book seemed to say, do whatever it takes to stop the attack on you. It even said that war was okay as a response to attack. And now this is a direct quote, despots cannot be allowed to flourish, but must be stopped in their despotism. It also says, choosing to be godlike does not mean you choose to be a martyr, and it certainly doesn't mean you choose to be a victim. Now you are saying that highly evolved beings would never end the corporal life of another. How can these statements stand side by side?
Read the material in Book One again.
Closely. My responses there were all given and must all be considered within the context you created, the context of your question. Read your statement on the bottom of page 127 in Book One. In that statement, you allow as to how you are not now operating at a level of mastery. You say that other people's words and actions sometimes hurt you. Given that this is so, you asked how best to respond to these experiences of hurt or damage. My responses are all to be taken within that context. I first of all said that the day will come when the words and actions of others will not hurt you. Like Obi-Wan Kenobi, you will experience no damage, even when someone is killing you. This is the level of mastery that has been reached by the members of the societies I am now describing. The beings in these societies are very clear who they are and who they are not. It is very difficult to cause one of them to experience being damaged or hurt, least of all by placing their corporal body in danger. They would simply exit their body and leave it for you if you felt the need to hurt it so much. The next point I made in my response to you in Book One is that you react the way you do to the words and action of others because you have forgotten who you are. But I say there, that is all right. That is part of the growth process. It is part of evolution. Then I make a very important statement. All during your growth process, you must work at the level at which you are, the level of understanding, the level of willingness, the level of remembrance. Everything else I have said there is to be taken within that context. I have even said on page 129, I assume for the purpose of this discussion that you are still seeking to realize, make real, who you truly are. Within the context of a society of beings who do not remember who they really are, the responses I gave you in Book One stand as given. But you didn't ask me those questions here. You asked me here to describe the highly evolved societies of the universe. Not only with regard to the subject at hand, but with regard to all the other topics we will cover here, it will be beneficial if you do not see these descriptions of other cultures as criticisms of your own. There are no judgments here. Nor will there be any condemnation if you do things differently, react differently, than beings who are more evolved. And so what I have said here is that the highly evolved beings of the universe would never kill another sentient being in anger. First, they would not experience anger. Second, they would not end the corporal experience of any other being without that being's permission. And third, to answer specifically your specific inquiry, they would never feel attacked, even from outside their own society or species. Because to feel attacked, you have to feel that someone is taking something from you, your life, your loved ones, your freedom, your property, your possessions, something. And a highly evolved being would never experience that. Because a highly evolved being would simply give you whatever you thought you needed so badly that you were prepared to take it by force, even if it cost the evolved being its corporal life. Because the evolved being knows she can create everything all over again. She would quite naturally give it all away to a lesser being who did not know this. Highly evolved beings are therefore not martyrs, nor are they victims of anyone's despotism. Yet it goes beyond this. Not only is the highly evolved being clear that he can create everything all over again, he is also clear that he doesn't have to. He is clear that he needed none of it to be happy or to survive. He understands that he requires nothing exterior to himself, and that the himself which he is has nothing to do with anything physical. Lesser evolved beings and races are not always clear about this. Finally, the highly evolved being understands that she and her attackers are one. She sees the attackers as a wounded part of herself. Her function in that circumstance is to heal all wounds so that the all-in-one can again know itself as it really is. Giving away all that she has would be like giving yourself an aspirin.
Whoa, what a concept. What an understanding. But I need to go back to something you said earlier. You said that highly evolved beings...
Let's abbreviate that as HEBS from now on. It's a long name to have to use over and over again.
Good, okay. Well, you said that HEBS would never end the corporal experience of another without the being's permission.
That's right.
But why would one being give another being permission to end its physical life?
There could be any number of reasons. It might offer itself as food, for instance, or to serve some other necessity, like stopping a war.
You know, this must be why, even in our own culture, there are those who would never kill any animal for food or hides without asking the spirit of that being for permission.
Yes, this is the way of your Native Americans, who would not even pick a flower, an herb, or a plant without having this communication. All of your indigenous cultures do the same. Interestingly, those are the tribes and cultures that you call primitive.
Oh, man, are you telling me I can't even pick a radish without asking if it's okay?
You can do anything you choose to do. You asked me what Hebs would do.
So Native Americans are highly evolved beings?
As with all races and species, some are and some are not. It's an individual thing. As a culture, though, they have reached a very high level. The cultural myths which inform much of their experience are very elevated. But you have forced them to mix their cultural myths with your own.
Wait a minute. What are you saying? The red man was a savage. That's why we had to kill them by the thousands and put the rest in land prisons we called reservations. Why, even now we take their sacred sites and put golf courses on them. We have to. Otherwise, they might honor their sacred sites and remember their cultural stories and perform their sacred rituals. We can't have that.
I get the picture.
No, really. Why, if we hadn't taken over and tried to erase their culture, they might have impacted ours. Then how would we have wound up? We'd be respecting the land and the air, refusing to poison our rivers. And then where would our industry be? The whole population would probably still be walking around naked, with no shame, bathing in the river, living off the land, instead of crowding into high-rises and condominiums and bungalows and going to work in the asphalt jungle. Why, we'd probably still be listening to ancient wisdom teachings around a campfire instead of watching TV. We would have made no progress at all.
Well, fortunately, you know what's good for you.
Tell me more about highly evolved civilizations and highly evolved beings, will you? Outside of the fact that they don't kill each other for any reason, what else makes them different from us?
They share.
Hey, we share.
No, they share everything, with everyone. Not a being goes without. All the natural resources of their world, of their environment, are divided equally and distributed to everyone. A nation or a group or a culture isn't thought to own a natural resource simply because it happens to occupy the physical location where that resource is found. The planet or planets, which a group of species calls home, is understood to belong to everyone, to all the species in that system. Indeed, the planet or group of planets itself is understood to be a system. It is viewed as a whole system, not as a bunch of little parts or elements, any one of which can be eliminated, decimated, or eradicated without damage to the system itself.
The ecosystem, as we call it.
Well, it's larger than that. It's not just the ecology, which is the relationship of the planet's natural resources to the planet's inhabitants. It's also the relationship of the inhabitants to themselves, to each other, and to the environment. It's the interrelationship of all the species of life.
The species system.
Yes, I like that word. It's a good word. Because what we're talking about is larger than the ecosystem. It's truly the species system, or what your Buckminster Fuller called the noosphere.
I like species system better. It's easier to understand. I always wondered what in blazes the noosphere was.
Bucky likes your word, too. He's not attached. He always liked whatever made things simpler or easier.
You're talking to Buckminster Fuller now? You've turned this dialogue into a seance?
Let's just say I have reason to know that the essence which identified itself as Buckminster Fuller is delighted with your new word.
Wow, that's great. I mean, that is so cool. Just to be able to know that.
It is cool, I agree.
So in highly evolved cultures, it's the species system that matters.
Yes, but it isn't that individual beings don't matter. Quite to the contrary. The fact that individual beings do matter is reflected in the fact that effect on the species system is uppermost when considering any decision. It is understood that the species system supports all life and every being at the optimum level. Doing nothing that would harm the species system is therefore a statement that each individual being is important. Not only the individual beings with status or influence or money, not only the individual beings with power or size or the presumption of greater self-awareness, all beings and all species in the system.
How can that work? How can that be possible? On our planet, the wants and needs of some species have to be subordinated to the wants and needs of others, or we couldn't experience life as we know it.
You are moving dangerously close to the time when you will not be able to experience life as you know it, precisely because you have insisted on subordinating the needs of most species to the desires of only one.
The human species.
Yes, and not even all members of that species, but only a few. Not even the largest number, which might have some logic to it, but by far the smallest.
The richest and the most powerful.
You've called it.
Well, here we go. Another tirade against the rich and the accomplished.
Far from it. Your civilization does not deserve a tirade any more than a room full of small children deserves one. Human beings will do what they are doing, to themselves and to each other, until they realize that it is no longer in their best interests. No amount of tirades will change that. If tirades changed things, your religions would have been far more effective long before now.
Whoa, zip, zing, you're getting everyone today, aren't you?
I'm doing nothing of the sort. Are these simple observations stinging you? Look then to see why. This much we both know. The truth is often uncomfortable. Yet this book has come to bring the truth, as have others which I have inspired, and movies and television programs.
I'm not sure I want to encourage people to watch television.
For better or worse, television is now the campfire of your society. It is not the medium that is taking you in directions you say you do not wish to go. It is the messages you allow to be placed there. Do not denounce the medium. You may use it one day yourself to send a different message.
Let me get back if I can. Can I get back to my original question here? I'm still wanting to know how a species system can work with the needs of all species in the system treated equally.
The needs are all treated equally, but the needs themselves are not all equal. It's a question of proportion and of balance. Highly evolved beings deeply understand that all living things within what we have chosen here to call the species system have needs which must be met if the physical forms that both create and sustain the system are to survive. They also understand that not all these needs are the same or equal in terms of the demands they place on the system itself. Let's use your own species system as an example.
Okay.
Let's use the two living species you call trees and humans.
I'm with you.
Obviously, trees do not require as much daily maintenance as humans, so their needs are not equal, yet they are interrelated. That is, one species depends on the other. You must pay as much attention to the needs of trees as to the needs of humans. But the needs themselves are not as great. Yet if you ignore the needs of one species of living thing, you do so at your peril. The book I mentioned earlier as being of critical importance, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, describes all of this magnificently. It says that trees take carbon dioxide out of your atmosphere, using the carbon portion of this atmospheric gas to make carbohydrates, that is, to grow. Nearly everything of which a plant is made, including roots, stems, leaves, even the nuts and fruits which the tree bears, are carbohydrates. Meanwhile, the oxygen portion of this gas is released by the tree. It is the tree's waste matter. Human beings, on the other hand, need oxygen to survive. Without trees to convert the carbon dioxide, which is plentiful in your atmosphere, into oxygen, which is not, you, as a species, cannot survive. You, in turn, release, breathe out, carbon dioxide, which the tree needs to survive. Do you see the balance?
Of course. It's ingenious.
Thank you. Now, please quit destroying it.
Oh, come on. We plant two trees for every one we cut down.
Yes, it will take only 300 years for those trees to grow to the strength and size which will allow them to produce as much oxygen as many of the old growth trees you are chopping down. The oxygen manufacturing plant, which you call the Amazon rainforest, can be replaced in its capacity to balance your planet's atmosphere in, say, 2,000 or 3,000 years. Not to worry. You're clearing thousands of acres every year, but not to worry.
Why? Why are we doing that?
You clear the land so that you can raise cattle to slaughter and eat. Raising cattle is said to provide more income for the indigenous peoples of the rainforest country. So all this is proclaimed to be about making the land productive. In highly evolved civilizations, however, eroding the species system is not looked at as productive, but rather destructive. So Hebs have found a way to balance the total needs of the species system. They choose to do this rather than serve the desires of one small portion of the system. For they realize that no species within the system can survive if the system itself is destroyed.
Man, that seems so obvious. That seems so painfully obvious.
The obviousness of it may be even more painful on Earth in the years ahead if your so-called dominant species doesn't wake up.
I get that, man. I get it big. And I want to do something about it, but I feel so helpless. I feel sometimes so helpless. What can I do to bring about change?
There's nothing you have to do, but there's a great deal you can be.
Okay, help me with that.
Human beings have been trying to solve problems at the doingness level for a long time without much success. That's because true change is always made at the level of being, not doing. Oh, you've made certain discoveries, all right, and you've advanced your technologies, and so in some ways you've made your lives easier. But it's not clear whether you've made them better. And on the larger issues of principle, you have made very slow progress. You are facing many of the same problems of principle that you've faced for centuries on your planet. Your idea that Earth exists for the exploitation of the dominant species is a good example. You clearly will not change what you are doing around that until you change how you are being. You have to change your idea about who you are in relationship to your environment and everything in it before you will ever act differently. It is a matter of consciousness, and you have to raise consciousness before you can change consciousness.
How can we do that?
Stop being quiet about all this. Speak up, raise a ruckus, raise the issues. You might even raise some collective consciousness. On just one issue, for instance. Why not grow hemp and use it to make paper? Do you have any idea how many trees it takes just to supply your world with daily newspapers? To say nothing of paper cups, carry-out cartons, and paper towels. Hemp can be grown inexpensively and harvested easily, and used not only for making paper, but the strongest rope and the longest-lasting clothing, and even some of the most effective medicines your planet can provide. In fact, cannabis can be planted so inexpensively, and harvested so easily, and has so many wonderful uses, that there is a huge lobby working against it. Too many would lose too much to allow the world to turn to this simple plant, which can be grown almost anywhere. This is just one example of how greed replaces common sense in the conduct of human affairs. So give this program to everyone you know. Not only so that they get this, but so that they get everything else that's being said here. And there's still a great deal more.
Yeah, but you know what? I'm getting depressed, like a lot of people said they felt after Book 2. Is this going to be more and more talk about how we're destroying things here and really blowing it? Because I'm not sure I'm really up for this, you know.
Are you up for being inspired? Are you up for being excited? Because learning about and exploring what other civilizations, advanced civilizations, are doing should both inspire and excite you. Think of the possibilities. Think of the opportunities. Think of the golden tomorrows just around the corner.
If we wake up.
You will wake up. You are waking up. The paradigm is shifting. The world is changing. It's happening right in front of your eyes. This program is part of it. You are part of it. Remember, you are in the room to heal the room. You are in the space to heal the space. There is no other reason for you to be here. Don't give up. Don't give up. The grandest adventure has just begun.
All right. All right. I choose to be inspired by the example and wisdom of highly evolved beings, not discouraged by it.
Good. That is a wise choice, given where you say you want to go as a species. You have much you can remember from observing these beings. Hebs live in unity, with a deep sense of interrelatedness. Their behaviors are created by their sponsoring thoughts, which you might call the basic guiding principles of their society. Your behaviors, too, are created by your sponsoring thoughts, or the basic guiding principles of your society.
Well, what are the basic guiding principles of a Heb society?
Their first guiding principle is we are all one. Every decision, every choice, all of what you would call morals and ethics is based upon this principle. The second guiding principle is everything in the one interrelates. Under this principle, no one member of a species could or would keep something from another simply because he had it first, or it's his possession, or it's in short supply. The mutual dependency of all living things in the species system is recognized and honored. The relative needs of every species of living organism within the system are always kept in balance because they are always kept in mind.
Does this second guiding principle mean that there is no such thing as personal ownership?
Not as you understand it. A Heb experiences personal ownership in the sense of holding personal responsibility for every good thing in his care. The closest word in your language to describe what a highly evolved being feels about what you would call a prized possession is stewardship. A Heb is a steward, not an owner. The word own and your concept behind it are not part of the culture of Hibs. There's no such thing as possession in the sense of something being a personal belonging. Hebs do not possess, Hebs caress. That is, they hold, embrace, love, and care for things, but they do not own them. Humans possess, Hebs caress. In your language, this is how the difference could be described. Earlier in your history, humans felt they had the right to personally possess everything they laid their hands on. This included wives and children, land and the riches of the land. Stuff and whatever other stuff, their stuff, could get them was also theirs. Much of this belief is still held as truth today in human society. Humans became obsessed with this concept of ownership. Hebs, who watched this from a distance, called this your possession obsession. Now, as you have evolved, you understand more and more that you can really, truly possess nothing, least of all your spouses and children. Many of you, though, still cling to the notion that you can possess land and everything on it, under it, and over it. Yes, you even talk about air rights. The heads of the universe, by contrast, deeply understand that the physical planet beneath their feet is not something that can be possessed by any single one of them. Although an individual head may be granted through the mechanisms of his or her society, a parcel of land for which to care. If she is a good steward of the land, she may be allowed, asked, to pass stewardship onto her offspring and they to theirs. Yet if at any time either he or his offspring prove to be poor stewards of the land is no longer kept in their care.
Wow, if that were the guiding principle here, half the industries in the world would have to give up their property.
And the world's ecosystem would dramatically improve overnight. You see, in a highly evolved culture, a corporation, as you call it, would never be allowed to despoil the land in order to make a profit, for it would be clearly seen that the quality of the lives of the very people who own or work for the corporation are being irrevocably damaged. What profit is there in that?
Well, the damage might not be felt for many years, whereas the benefits are realized right here, right now. So that would be what's called, I guess, short-term profit, long-term loss. But who cares about long-term loss if you're not going to be there to experience it?
Highly evolved beings do. But then, they live a lot longer.
How much longer?
Many times longer. In some Heb societies, beings live forever, or as long as they choose to remain in corporal form. So in Heb societies, individual beings are usually around to experience the long-term consequences of their actions.
How do they manage to stay alive so long?
Of course, they are never not alive, any more than you are. But I know what you mean. You mean with the body.
Yes. So how do they manage to stay with the body for so long? Why is this possible?
Well, first, because they don't pollute their air, their water, and their land. They do not put chemicals into the ground, for instance, which are then taken up by plants and animals and brought into the body upon consumption of those plants and animals. A Heb, in fact, would never consume an animal, much less fill the ground and the plants which the animal eats with chemicals, then fill the animal itself with chemicals, and then consume it. The Heb would correctly assess such a practice to be suicidal. So Hebs do not pollute their environment, their atmosphere, and their own corporal bodies as humans do. Your bodies are magnificent creations made to last infinitely longer than you allow them to. Hebs also exhibit different psychological behaviors that equally prolong life.
Such as?
A Heb never worries, and wouldn't even understand the human concept of worry or stress. Neither would a Heb hate or feel rage or jealousy or panic. Therefore, the Heb is not produced biochemical reactions within her own body that eat away at it and destroy it. A Heb would call this eating itself, and a Heb would no sooner consume itself than it would consume another corporal being.
How does a Heb manage this? Are humans capable of such control over emotions?
First, a Heb understands that all things are perfect. That there is a process in the universe that is working itself out, and that all they have to do is not interfere with it. So a Heb never worries, because a Heb understands the process. And to answer your second question, yes, humans have this control, although some don't believe they have it, and others simply don't choose to exercise it. The few who do make an effort live a great deal longer, assuming chemicals and atmospheric poisons haven't killed them, and also assuming that they haven't voluntarily poisoned themselves in other ways.
Wait a minute. We voluntarily poison ourselves?
Some of you do, yes.
How?
As I said, you eat poisons. Some of you drink poisons. Some of you even smoke poisons. A highly evolved being finds such behaviors incomprehensible. He can't imagine why you would deliberately take into your body substances that you know can't be doing you any good.
Well, we find eating, drinking, and smoking certain things enjoyable.
Ahab finds life in the body enjoyable, and can't imagine doing anything that she knows ahead of time could limit or terminate that or make it painful.
Well, some of us don't believe that eating red meat plentifully or drinking alcohol or smoking plants will limit or terminate our lives or make them painful.
Then your observational skills are very dull. They need sharpening. Ahab would suggest that you simply look around you.
Yes, well, what else can you tell me about what life is like in the highly evolved societies of the universe?
There is no shame.
No shame?
Nor any such thing as guilt.
Well, how about when a being proves to be a bad steward of the land? You just said they take the land away from him. Doesn't that mean he's being judged and found guilty?
No, it means he's been observed and found unable. In highly evolved cultures, beings would never be asked to do something they demonstrated an inability to do.
What if they still wanted to do it?
They would not want to.
Why not?
Their own demonstrated inability would eliminate their desire. This is a natural outcome of their understanding that their inability to do a particular thing could potentially damage another. This they would never do, for to damage the other is to damage the self, and they know this.
So it is still self-preservation that drives the experience, just like on Earth.
Certainly. The only thing that's different is their definition of self. A human defines self very narrowly. You speak of yourself, your family, your community. Ahab defines self quite differently. She speaks of the self, the family, the community.
As if there were only one.
There is only one. That's the whole point.
I understand.
And so in a highly evolved culture, a being would never, for instance, insist on raising offspring if that being consistently demonstrated to itself its own inability to do so. This is why in highly evolved cultures, children don't raise children. Offspring are given to elders to raise. This doesn't mean that new offspring are torn from those who gave them life, taken from their arms, and given to virtual strangers to raise. It's nothing like that. In these cultures, elders live closely with the young ones. They are not shuffled off to live by themselves. They are not ignored and left to work out their own final destinies. They are honored, revered, and held close as part of a loving, caring, vibrant community. When a new offspring arrives, the elders are right there, deep within the heart of that community and that family, and their raising of the offspring is as organically correct as it feels in your society to have the parents do this. The difference is that though they always know who their parents are, the closest term in their language would be life givers, these offspring are not asked to learn about the basics of life from beings who are still learning about the basics of life themselves. In Heb societies, the elders organize and supervise the learning process, as well as housing, feeding, and caring for the children. Offspring are raised in an environment of wisdom and love, great, great patience, and deep understanding. The young ones who gave them life are usually off somewhere, meeting the challenges and experiencing the joys of their own young lives. They may spend as much time with their offspring as they choose. They may even live in the dwelling of the elders with the children, to be right there with them in a home environment, and to be experienced by them as part of it. It is all a very unified, integrated experience. But it is the elders who do the raising, who take the responsibility. And it is an honor, for upon the elders is placed the responsibility for the future of the entire species. And in Heb societies, it is recognized that this is more than should be asked of young ones. I touched on this earlier when we talked about how you raise offspring on your planet and how you might change that.
Yes, and thank you for further explaining this and how it could work. So getting back, Ahab does not feel guilt or shame, no matter what he does?
No, because guilt and shame is something which is imposed on a being from outside of itself. It can then be internalized, no question about that, but it is initially imposed from the outside, always. No divine being, and all beings are divine, ever knows itself or anything it is doing to be shameful or guilty until someone outside of itself labels it that way. In your culture, is a baby ashamed of its bathroom habits? Not until you tell it to be. Does a child feel guilty for pleasuring itself with its genitals? Of course not. Not until you tell it to feel guilty. The degree to which a culture is evolved is demonstrated by the degree to which it labels a being or an action shameful or guilty.
Are no actions to be called shameful? Is a person never guilty, no matter what he does?
As I've already told you, there is no such thing as right or wrong.
There are still some people who don't understand that.
To understand what is being said here, this dialogue must be read in its entirety. Taking any statement out of context could make it not understandable. Books 1 and 2 contain detailed explanations of the wisdom above. You are asking me here to describe the highly evolved cultures of the universe. They already understand this wisdom.
How else are these cultures different from our own?
In many other ways. They do not compete. They realize that when one loses, everyone loses. They therefore do not create sports and games which teach children and perpetuate in adults the extraordinary thought that someone winning while another is losing is entertainment. Also, as I said, they share everything. When another is in need, they would never dream of keeping or hoarding something they had simply because it was in scarce supply. On the contrary, that would be their very reason for sharing it. In your society, the price goes up for that which is rare, if you share it at all. In this way, you ensure that if you are going to share something which you possess, at least you'll be enriched doing it. Highly evolved beings are also enriched by sharing rare things. The only thing that is different between Hebs and humans is how Hebs define being enriched. A Heb feels enriched by sharing everything freely, without needing to profit. Indeed, this feeling is the profit. There are several guiding principles of your culture which produce your behaviors. As I said earlier, one of your most basic ones is survival of the fittest. This might be called your second guiding principle. It underlies everything your society has created, its economics, its politics, its religions, its education, its social structures. Yet to a highly evolved being, the principle itself is an oxymoron. It is self-contradicting. Since the first guiding principle of a Heb is we are all one, the one is not fit until the all is fit. Survival of the fittest is therefore impossible, or the only thing that is possible, therefore a contradiction, since the fittest is not fit until it is. Are you following this?
Yes. We call it communism.
On your planet, you have rejected out of hand any system which does not allow for the advancement of one being at the expense of another. If a system of governance or economics requires an attempt at equitable distribution to all of the benefits created by all, with the resources belonging to all, you have said that system of governance violates the natural order. Yet in highly evolved cultures, the natural order is equitable sharing.
Even if a person or group has done nothing to deserve it? Even if there has been no contribution to the common good? Even if they are evil?
The common good is life. If you are alive, you are contributing to the common good. It is very difficult for a spirit to be in physical form. To agree to take such a form is, in one sense, a great sacrifice, yet one that is necessary and even enjoyed if the all is to know itself experientially and to recreate itself anew in the next grandest version of the greatest vision it ever held about who it is. It is important to understand why we came here.
We?
The souls which make up the collective.
You're losing me.
As I've already explained, there is only one soul, one being, one essence. Some of you call this God. This single essence individuates itself as everything in the universe. In other words, all that is. This includes all the sentient beings, or what you have chosen to call souls.
So, God is every soul that is?
Every soul that is now, ever was, and ever will be.
So God is a collective?
That's the word I chose. Because it comes closest in your language to describing how things are.
Not a single awesome being, but a collective?
It doesn't have to be one or the other. Think outside the box.
God is both? A single awesome being, which is a collective of individualized parts?
Good, very good.
And why did the collective come to Earth?
To express itself in physicality. To know itself in its own experience. To be God, as I've already explained in detail in Book 1.
You created us to be you?
We did, indeed. That is exactly why you were created.
And humans were created by a collective?
Your own Bible said, let us create man in our image and after our likeness, before the translation was changed. Life is the process through which God creates itself and then experiences the creation. This process of creation is ongoing and eternal. It is happening all the time. Relativity and physicality are the tools with which God works. Pure energy, what you call spirit, is what God is. This essence is truly the Holy Spirit. By a process through which energy becomes matter, spirit is embodied in physicality. This is done by the energy literally slowing itself down, changing its oscillation, or what you would call vibration. That which is all does this in parts. That is, parts of the whole do this. These individuations of spirit are what you have chosen to call souls. In truth, there is only one soul, reshaping and reforming itself. This might be called the Reformation. You are all gods in formation. God's information. That is your contribution, and it is sufficient unto itself. To put this simply, by taking form, you have already done enough. I want, I need nothing more. You have contributed to the common good. You have made it possible for that which is common, the one common element, to experience that which is good. Even you have written that God created the heavens and the earth, and the animals who walk upon the land, and the birds of the air, and the fishes of the sea. And it was very good.